Shalom and welcome to On the House, the podcast where industry experts and professionals discuss real estate in Israel. I'm your host, Debbie Goldfischer, real estate agent, founder and editor-in-chief of buyitinisrael.com. Join us as we explore market trends, legal and tax issues, purchasing tips, neighborhoods throughout Israel, and much more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move. Welcome back to On the House, the Israel Real Estate Podcast. After a much-needed break for the holidays, we're excited to launch a brand new season dedicated to the ins and outs of purchasing pre-owned homes in Israel. These past few weeks have been especially challenging for us all, with the loss of many brave soldiers and the heartbreak of families left behind. The atmosphere in Israel is heavy with uncertainty and sorrow, yet amidst this turmoil, I find strength. It's a stark reminder that the future for Jews is right here in Israel. Having come from the UK, I see the shifting landscape and the growing threats make it clear that our safety and stability is here. The global environment is changing, and while we navigate these challenges, and we all eagerly await the US election results, that there is only one leader, Manhig Echad, and that is Hashem. Now, turning our focus back to real estate in Israel. We've previously explored the appeal of purchasing off-plan properties, especially for those abroad looking for long-term investments. But for many, new construction is not the right fit. Whether it's the desire for immediate possession, aversion to the complexities of construction, or simply a preference for a specific area, the journey of buying a second-hand property presents unique challenges that we'll delve into this season. For our first episode, we're thrilled to welcome advocate Jane Ullman, a seasoned real estate lawyer and a very dear friend. Jane brings over 20 years of experience in navigating the Israeli real estate landscape, especially for English-speaking clients. As a partner and notary at Rachlin Ullman Law Offices, she's been a tremendous support to Biden Israel over the years, helping us establish our business and guiding countless clients through their real estate journeys. Originally from California, Jane has made Israel her home since 1995 and is a well-respected speaker on real estate topics both here and abroad. So let's get started. Welcome, Jane.
Thanks so much for having me.
A pleasure. I'm so glad you're joining us today. As we kick off this new season, we're going to focus on building a trustworthy team of professionals to guide our listeners through the complexities of purchasing a pre-owned home in Israel. So the first thing I want to ask you, Jane, somebody is looking to make a purchase. As we said, they've decided to buy something that's pre-owned. At what stage should they contact you as the lawyer?
People often contact me when they're first looking to understand the differences between various areas, but mostly they kind of want to get a feel for the process as they're starting to dip their toe into the water. They often call me and say, what's the first thing I should do? Who's the first person I should call? So generally people will call me and I'll give a short spiel of the overview, what to expect, what are the things that they should be looking for, what questions they should be asking as they're looking at property. We often tell people actually to start with a mortgage broker if they're thinking of taking a mortgage or their finance person, because setting the budget is really the first step. You can't effectively look for a property even with an agent if you don't know your budget.
Absolutely. I always tell people you can't go shopping until you know what's in your wallet.
Exactly.
Right. So we had a couple of seasons ago, we had some episodes on trying to figure out what your budget is and figuring out how much you can borrow. So we're assuming at this point, people know how much they have, and they're actively looking, whether it's with an agent or on their own. We also had an episode on working with agents and how that works. So ideally, you're saying that they should contact you prior to finding the right property?
Generally, they contact me before they've actually found the right property to make sure that they're asking the right questions and they understand how it would work from a timeline perspective, from a payment perspective, so that they know what they're really getting into as they're looking. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people call me, Jane, we saw this property and now we want to put in an offer. I often get called as they're putting in the offer to make sure that they're asking the right questions and to make sure that they're including all of the relevant elements to an offer, because it's not just the price, as you know. The date of possession is up for debate. It's up for negotiation. What's included in the house, all these kinds of things. And sometimes they have registration questions that they want to ask me before they put in the offer.
And very importantly, they shouldn't sign anything.
Of course.
Without showing it to you.
Exactly. So that's just one thing to touch upon. Sometimes agents especially would like clients to sign what's known as a Zichron Dvarim, which is a memorandum of understanding. And there's a big difference between signing that and signing like a registration form if you were buying new property or something like that. You really do not want to sign a Zichron Dvarim. It's considered a binding contract in Israel.
So you don't sign anything? You
sign nothing until you show it to an attorney. And we do not sign, as a matter of course, a Zichron Dvarim because it's basically a badly unnegotiated binding contract. Mm-hmm. So offers in Israel are non-binding. They're put in through your agent. And that kind of sets the ball in motion. And then we get to work.
Okay. So somebody has found the property. Their agent has agreed on a price, a move-in date, general payment terms, let's say. They contact you. What are the next steps?
The next steps is, as I said, I explain the process, what we should be expecting. And then what we really want to have happen is to get a draft contract from the other attorney. I always tell my clients that symbolizes the opening of the games, as it were.
The seller's attorney prepares the contract?
The seller's attorney always prepares the contract, okay. Sends it out to the buyer's attorney. Once we have that draft contract, that signifies that the seller is not meant to be marketing that property to any other potential buyer while we are doing our due diligence, unless they notify us that they're marketing it to or negotiating with more than one party at the same time. Generally, if a seller is negotiating with a second party at the same time, I don't like to do those deals. It ends up in a very pressurized kind of, I would even call it a bullying situation. Sign by tomorrow, we're going to sell it to someone else. You can't effectively do your due diligence in situations like that. Mm-hmm. So we need to have enough time to effectively do our due diligence. Usually takes 2 to 3 weeks. People always ask me the timing. That's what we're looking at. It's kind of running parallel horses around a track. We get the contract and then we begin. Each side is obligated to act in good faith, meaning that as a buyer, we cannot be negotiating with, say, the next door neighbor at the same time to see which one has better terms because we've effectively asked them to take the property off the market while we do our due diligence. So each side is bound to act in good faith. But if any of the pieces of this puzzle that we're looking at through our due diligence don't fit, you can back out of the deal as long as you've acted in good faith. So putting in the offer is basically buying yourself time. I always tell my clients it's empowering. It's buying yourself enough time to properly do the due diligence to explore whether or not this is the right property for you. And we have to work effectively in a normal amount of time and move things forward. But that's really what that period of time is for, because once you sign a contract in Israel, it is binding. There are no contingencies. I always explain to people there are no contingencies for financing. There are no contingencies for inspection once you sign. All of those processes have to be done between the period of when you've put in an offer and when you sign the contract. So it's basically my job to captain that team, to choreograph that dance, make sure that we're bringing in all the right professionals to help us get a full picture of due diligence.
Is the offer contingent on anything?
Sometimes people make an offer contingent on inspection or the appraisal or something like that. But I do like to align expectations with my clients. It's really not like it is in America, North America, I would say, where let's say that you got an inspection report, you hand it to the seller, and now the seller does all of the repairs. It's really not like that. Mm-hmm. It's more for your edification as a buyer.
You know what you're buying.
Exactly. It's much more like a process. I always tell people of buying kind of like a used car, mm-hmm. right? Okay, this is what you're getting for this price. Can we live with it? Do we like it? The fender's a bit dented and the air conditioning's a bit weak, but do we still want it?
Right. We have an episode coming up with an engineer who's going to explain what he does. But what you're saying is that the inspection is to understand what you're getting and to get an idea of what it would cost to repair those things.
Exactly. Sometimes they'll do some repairs, maybe a bigger thing. You know, what we're really looking for is money. That's exactly what I tell people. All of these things are budgetary. You want to make sure that you understand what it is that you're getting for your money and how much it will cost you total in the end.
Mm-hmm. So if they find a major issue, let's just say, for example, major issues with the water system, or you know, there's a leak that's very hard to repair or something, can they back out?
Yes. As long as you find it before you've signed the contract, which is why we do inspection before we sign the contract, mm-hmm. because that would mean that the due diligence helped you uncover things that make the deal not attractive to you anymore. Sometimes people, you know, the sellers would want to lower the price, but there are certain issues which are too intimidating, especially for our clients just now coming to Israel or something like that. They don't want to get into it. It's not such a bargain. So more often than that, if there are major things which come up in inspection, my clients will decide not to buy that property.
And similarly, if they don't get the mortgage approved, they don't get the right amount to buy the property, they can back out.
Again, as long as we have that information before you sign, because there are no contingencies, which is why two important pieces of our due diligence as buyers is if you need a mortgage, A, to get pre-approval through a bank, I always recommend using a good mortgage broker, especially in today's banking environment. It's very difficult to get it done without a good mortgage broker. And B, to make sure that you have an appraiser, because the fact that the bank said that they'll give you, say, 50% financing on a property of 4 million shekels doesn't necessarily mean that they'll give you that 2 million shekels no matter what you buy. Mm-hmm. Because the bank financing is based on either the appraisal or the contract price, the lower of the two. So certain things will affect an appraiser, which is part of also our due diligence, an appraisal. Let's say that there's a lot of area in the property that doesn't have a proper permit, that will not appraise at full value.
Right. So we're gonna right. cover those issues right. in the next couple of weeks or so mm-hmm. with an appraiser. But so we've got the mortgage approved. We've completed the inspection by the engineer. We understand what we're buying. What happens now?
So in the meantime, while we will have been doing all of those tracks of due diligence, we're also negotiating the actual contract. Mm-hmm. The wording of the contract includes the business terms.
Sorry, you start the negotiations, you start reviewing the contract in parallel.
Correct. Because there's a timing issue, right? There's only so much time that we can buy while they have the property off the market without it being a done deal for them before they get antsy and they don't want to lose potential buyers. Sure. So we have to kind of move things along in a normal fashion. So I will be negotiating the actual contract while we've sent in an inspector and while at the same time we're making sure that the client has mortgage approval, for mm-hmm. instance. So in the contract, we are negotiating the business terms, the date of possession, the payment terms, which also is connected with, you know, your mortgage. If the seller has a mortgage, when are we paying that off? How long do you have to carry your mortgage if you have to take it in the middle before you're getting the property? So we're looking at payment structure. We're looking at what's included in the house. Don't forget that as far as people from outside of Israel are concerned, the house here is being sold stripped. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include appliances. It doesn't include closets, which people might assume that are there. What is included? I like to have a very specific list, and the list goes both ways. What do they have to leave? And also to make sure that they don't leave things in the house that they couldn't be bothered to take out that you don't want, you know, mm-hmm. their old junky closet that now you have to pay someone to take out. So we want to make sure that there's a very specific list. And then the legal undertakings by each side, the declarations regarding the fact that the systems are in good working order, how they have to leave the house. What are the penalties if someone is late paying? What are the penalties if someone is late giving you over possession? All the legalities, that's also negotiated in the contract. There are no set template contracts. Obviously, everyone's working with their version of the contract, but each contract is individually negotiated and agreed upon.
Mm-hmm. Great. Jane, what about the due diligence, making sure that the registration of the house is in the names of the sellers and, you know, all the legal stuff?
Right. So that's one of the tracks of due diligence. Besides all of the checking of the physical property, one of the hats that your attorney wears in Israel is title search. Mm-hmm. There are no title companies in Israel. There are no escrow companies. There's no title insurance. So all of those things, all of those roles are played by a real estate attorney, which is why you're really looking for someone that's their specialization. Mm-hmm. Registration of property in Israel can be in a number of different places or a combination of those, depending on what area of the country it's built in and when it was built. So one of the first things that I'm looking at, even before we kind of get to the nitty-gritty of the contract, is to look at the registration. Is it registered, first of all, in the name of the person who is selling it to us? Because sometimes it's still registered in the mother who passed away and they haven't yet quite finished probating the will and getting it into the name of the person who's now selling it to us. Are there any liens? Does the seller have a mortgage? Let's look at the meterage that's listed. Does it match what we've been told? And this is also kind of where things get interesting in Israel because the systems of measuring meterage have changed over time, right? We're a young country and over the last 5 or 10 years, they've really started to make Seder in the registration. But at the time, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s even, the lands registry would register whatever was put under their nose. And it didn't necessarily reflect the fact that it had legal permits. Also, for instance, let's say that someone has a property and then they get a legal permit to add on meters. They're not obligated to update the lands registry. So sometimes you have a situation where the legal registration would be a combination of the basic registration, the original apartment that they had, say it was 70 square meters. And then over time, 10 years ago, they got a permit for another 30 meters. So now the apartment is legally 100 meters, but in the lands registry, it will show up as 70. So we have to have the second document of the 30 to make sure that the 100 meters that they're telling us that they're selling really is a legal 100 meters.
Wow. And you take care of all these inspections, all these investigations?
We pull the registration where it's available. And sometimes there are certain registrations that we can't see as attorneys. Like I can't necessarily see, for instance, the permits. I can pull off of the municipality site what's there. But once we have a situation like that, I will bring in a planning expert who is an appraiser for Israel. In Israel, mm-hmm. an appraiser wears two hats. They also do valuations for the bank, but they also do planning reports. Mm-hmm. And that's someone that I would really want to go out and give me a report, because it's not enough that I can see that there was a permit granted at one point. I want someone to go and make sure that it was fully signed, that they fulfilled all the conditions of the permit, that what they were allowed to build according to the permit is actually what they built, because someone has to go and check the apartment and make sure it matches. That's all above the pay grade of an attorney, but we bring a professional onto our team to help us do that. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if someone's buying on a plot of land, if they're owning a house, a freestanding house, the registration I can see is for the land. They don't register then the house on top of the land. You then have mm-hmm. to go pull the permits. So that's also another situation where we would bring in a planning expert to give us a planning report, because I can see that someone owns this plot of land in Zichron Yaakov, for instance, but I can't see what's built on it. Mm-hmm. So then we would want to make sure that the, you know, 250 meters that they were allowed to build is what they built. Because if it's 350 meters, then we have all sorts of the other questions of what happens to the illegal meterage.
Excellent. By the time they come to sign the purchase agreement, there's confidence that this is a kosher deal.
100%. It's my job to make sure that we get all of the information, lay it out on the table for my client. These are the facts, the good, the bad, the ugly. Do we like this deal? Then we sign. If not, then we go back to the drawing board.
Give me some examples of where it would be complicated or challenging to find this information. I would imagine like Moshavim and Over the Green Line, perhaps.
Over the Green Line, it's different. Places that it's registered can be two or three different places. You know, even some places like Ramat Givat Ze'ev, that's actually in the Jordanian Tabu. Like there's different places that things can be registered. Mm-hmm. There are yeshuvim that they basically early on in the state of Israel, they were allowed to do what they wanted. And now over time, they've had to kind of codify and regulate what's going on. So for instance, there are certain areas of Hashmonaim that they were allowed to kind of build even without proper permits. And now when they want to sell, the houses now have to conform to the current policy. And sometimes they have to go back and get permits. They have to go back and kind of make everything kosher, whereas originally they weren't required to. Mm-hmm. And also policies change over time. You know, even in Modi'in, where you and I live, originally you could get the clearances you need to transfer title even if you had illegal areas in your home. Mm-hmm. And today, Modi'in is very strict. Anything that doesn't match the permit, they send out an inspector to every property and they will ask you to put it back to the permit in order to get the needed clearances. Whereas other municipalities are much more lax. So mm-hmm. it really depends on where you're buying, but policies can change over
sure.
time.
So this can really add to the time that's required to close a deal.
Yes. Depending on what we're looking at, and if we need a full planning report, if we need to then, let's say, for instance, we get an engineering report, right, an inspection, and it has a water issue. Mm-hmm. So that's not necessarily a stopper. That doesn't necessarily ruin our deal. It depends on what's the problem. Is it because the shower is leaking, and that's an easy fix? Mm-hmm. Or is it because the water's coming in from some unknown place, and no matter what they've done over the last 10 years, they haven't been able to find it and fix it? So sometimes we have to add another layer of due diligence. We'll bring in a water expert, a contractor, to give us an actual quote of how much it would cost to fix something. So that's another step that we would do. We're trying to get all the facts before we buy something.
Great. So while the focus of this podcast is really on the buyers, I would like to add here that if somebody is selling, it would make sense for them to do a lot of the work before they're actually putting their property on the market, like ensure that everything is registered and documented so that you avoid this delay.
Registration definitely needs to be done as a seller. That's something that, you know, if there's any sort of issues with the registration, that will need to be done, because otherwise it will hold up the deal, or any deal that's done would have to be conditional. You know, sometimes, let's say, as my example that I gave, where you're buying from someone that they inherited the property and they haven't finished the registration, that deal would then become conditional. We're going to put the first payment in trust for 3 months or something like that, while we'll allow you the time to finish the registration. Had they done it before they put it on the market, everything would have been a lot cleaner, a lot faster. So yes, registration issues have to be taken care of. With regards to fixing and repairs, not all sellers take care of those things, but then you would have to take into account that the price would have to reflect the fact, the state of the apartment.
If I'm not mistaken, it sounds like as the lawyer, you're juggling three balls. You're basically dealing with the inspections and the professionals, whether it's the engineer, the mortgage, like make sure that everything is in place in order for the buyer to go ahead and buy. You're dealing with the due diligence, checking the status of the property and all the registration issues, and you're dealing with the negotiation on the contract. Is that right?
Correct. And you're also counseling your client so that they understand everything. You know, a big part of the job is to be what I call the surprise prevention crew, right? I want to make sure that everyone understands what it is they're buying. In our office, we either go through the contract clause by clause and make sure that someone understands what it is that we're signing because all the contracts are in Hebrew, or we prepare a short English language synopsis, you know, 4 or 5 pages, which lays out all the terms and the penalties and the pluses and the minuses or the special terms, you know, some sort of idiosyncrasies of that specific deal to our clients, because we're signing using power of attorney more often than not, at least probably 50% of the time. I'm the person that's signing because they're not yet here or they're outside of the country. And I need to make sure that I'm signing something that they approve, that they agree with. So it's my job to make sure that they understand the terms. So that's another ball that's in the air. And it's frightening for people. It's very overwhelming. The system is different. They don't understand the language. How are they going to move the money? You know, all these kinds of things. And they want to make sure that they feel confident in what they're doing.
Right. So people really, they trust you. They probably wouldn't make this purchase if they didn't trust somebody.
There's definitely has to be a strong element of confidence and trust in your attorney. Otherwise, it doesn't work because, again, I am their person on the ground. And a lot of people are flying blind. Sometimes they've never done this before. It's very difficult to go from being a, you know, competent adult in your home country where you know how to buy property and you know how to check things out yourself. And here you're just flying blind and you don't understand it. And things, especially my clients who are attorneys, have the hardest time because they're schooled in a certain way and they know what they're expecting and things are very different.
That is precisely why we're doing this podcast. I've seen many, many people. I had a heart surgeon a few years ago who was a professor in, you know, in his field. And when it came to buying real estate in Israel, he said to me himself, he said, I feel like a complete dummy. So the point here is to educate people, give them confidence and help them through this process.
Exactly.
So you touched on something which I wanted to talk about, and that is giving power of attorney, in particular to people who are not in Israel. I always recommend my clients when they're here in Israel to meet with a lawyer, often refer them to you, Jane, to give you power of attorney while they're here. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why it's important to do so?
It basically allows us to maneuver more quickly because powers of attorney, I do have people on the ground outside of the country that know how to get these powers of attorney done much more quickly than it used to be. We don't have to go to the consulate anymore in most situations. You sign the power of attorney with a local notary in most countries, and then there's something called apostille certification, which gives it international validity for the power of attorney. And we have people on the ground that know how to kind of move this through, and it takes a week or two. But sometimes there will be a property that comes up that you want to be able to take advantage of more quickly, or you're going to be somewhere where it's not convenient for you to do power of attorney. And also it saves money because if you sign in front of an attorney in Israel, that doesn't cost money. Whereas opposed if you're doing it outside of the country, you have to pay the notary, the apostille, the FedEx fees. So it just allows you to be able to kind of jump on an opportunity.
And also to meet the lawyer.
And to meet the lawyer, which I think is really important.
Sure.
But the power of attorney is basically a hedging of a bet. It puts a duck in place in case you want to take advantage of an opportunity. But I hold hundreds and hundreds of powers of attorney. And as I said before, we make sure that their client has approved whatever it is that we're signing before we would use it. I have many, many powers of attorney that I've never used, but we do not use powers of attorney unless the client authorizes us to use it for that specific purpose.
Is the power of attorney specifically for a specific property, or can it be a general power of attorney for any property that they find?
People do both. A specific power of attorney will definitely be needed if you are doing a mortgage, because a mortgage bank will not accept a general power of attorney. And in general, the banks have gotten a lot stricter than they used to be. We used to be able to hold, you know, 10 years ago, a general power of attorney, and I could kind of just do anything with it. But today, there's a lot more emphasis on having a specific power of attorney. A lot of times we'll start with a general power of attorney. I authorize you to, you know, basically buy any property in Israel in my name, which I use if you've approved. And then if you're taking a mortgage or if the seller's bank needs a specific power of attorney, et cetera, then as we go on, they'll do the specific power of attorney. General power of attorneys are useful for people sometimes that own several properties or that we need to kind of just do general things for them, or there's a time constraint where you want to have it set up that in case I saw two properties, I'm not sure which one we want to go for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while we're gone, we're willing to buy while we're outside of the country, then you might leave a general power of attorney so that I could move on your behalf in the meantime. But again, today, I think the possibility of getting a power of attorney outside of the country is less cumbersome than it once was when you mm-hmm. had to go to the consulate. So I'm not as stressed if they don't leave a power of attorney because I can get it done more quickly. But mm-hmm. it does save you money and give you more flexibility.
Okay, great. Okay, let's go back now to a topic that you touched upon earlier, and that is the payment schedule. So let's imagine somebody's found a property and they're going to take possession, which is not uncommon, let's say in 6 or 12 months' time. Right? I think overseas, usually the closing period is quicker, but sometimes here, or quite often here, the period is longer. Sometimes people are looking to buy something or they want to move in the summer, holidays when the kids are off, or they're building something and it's not going to be ready for another year. So how do you work out the payment schedule?
So first of all, it's important to realize that the terminology is really different. You know, everyone always asks me, when's the closing? In Israel, there isn't a closing the way that they have. For instance, in the United States, you have a contract signing, then you have payments as you go along in certain terms which need to be fulfilled, and the final payment is against keys.
Okay, so what's the typical breakdown? Right.
So I'm just making sure, because the people always ask me about the closing.
Excellent.
It really is negotiated. The first payment is generally somewhere around 20%. The absolute minimum is 10%.
Okay.
And at the end, it's also similar. The minimum is 10%. I'm going to explain why in a second. But anything in between can be negotiated. So I've had few, but sometimes a deal where you put down 10% and 90% at the end, that's very rare. And sometimes we've done it backwards. But it really depends on what the deal is and the subjective payment schedule that has been negotiated. I'll explain why. The first payment that is made when you're buying secondhand deals is made by a bank check. The reason why is we don't want to give any money as the buyers to the seller until we know that we have a security on that house. The seller doesn't want to register a security on his house unless he knows he has money in his hand. So the mechanism used in Israel is a bank check. It has to go through an Israeli bank. And we bring a bank check to the signing. The seller's attorney holds it for 3 days while I, as the buyer's attorney, go and register a type of lien on the house. So now we have a lien on the whole house.
How do we know that the seller's attorney is not cashing the check?
It's made out to the seller.
No, but how do you know that he's not giving it to the seller to cash?
I guess. But, you know, again, that's the mechanism used in Israel. Most attorneys who are doing this kind of law are not going to endanger their license by releasing it. They do have an obligation by law mm-hmm. as the trustee. They have an obligation by law, by the ethics code of being an attorney. That I've never had happen.
Good.
So we have 3 business days to register this lien. You have to understand that we then have a lien on the entire house and they have a portion of the money. Also in Israel, you don't have to show that you're a qualified buyer. So there's a huge risk also on that part of the buyer, a seller rather. He has registered a lien on his whole house where we've only paid a partial payment.
Mm.
So it's a very effective security. The court could force the deal. We could pay all the payments into a protected account, for instance, and force the deal. Mm. Once we have that security, the seller cannot back out, take another mortgage on the house, sign with someone else, et cetera. So we pay the first payment by this bank check, which is generally 20%, give or take. Sometimes it's 30, 40, 50%. It depends on what we have negotiated because sometimes the seller is specifically selling to us for our price because we have cash and we can give him 50% right away and he needs that in order to buy a different property, for instance.
Sure.
So it depends on what has been negotiated. And then you make other payments going along. A typical payment schedule would be, you know, a third down, a third in the middle, and a third at the end, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, but it also depends on how long that period of time is.
Exactly. And it also depends, for instance, if the seller has a mortgage, part of our payment schedules would go to pay off his mortgage, which mm-hmm. is protective for the buyer because we need to make sure at the end of the day that we have a property that does not have any encumbrances on it, that there's no debt.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to give the seller all of the money And what happens if he doesn't pay off the mortgage? So we'll say, okay, listen, it's a 3 million shekel deal. You have a 1 million shekel mortgage. We'll give you 1 million shekels in the beginning. The middle payment, we will specifically pay to your bank. There's a special letter that the bank gives. It's a legal undertaking that we pay against that letter. They then clear the title, and then we'll pay you the last 1 million shekels, for instance, against keys in possession.
Got it. Okay. We've spoken a lot on this podcast about index, which is basically inflation. Are the outstanding payments linked to index?
No. In general, secondhand deals do not have linkage exposure. That also goes because the whole philosophy behind indexing is that the contractor, when you're buying new property, is exposed to all of his suppliers and
his costs.
Materials, his costs that has to be indexed. And here, you know, you have a standing property. But it's important to realize that there can be variables for the buyer because you have currency fluctuation, right? And especially when you have payments spread out over 3, 6, 12, I even have done 2 deals in the last year of 24 months, you can have currency fluctuation. So that goes to the good and to the bad.
Sure.
You can make money on that or you can lose money on that. So it's an important variable.
Great. Okay. And what about VAT? Is there VAT value-added tax in the purchase price of a secondhand property?
No, there's no value-added tax unless you're buying from a company. And then there could be, and then it needs to be made. You have to make sure that it's negotiated in the contract that the seller's paying his own VAT. But in general, a private person selling to a private person, there is no VAT. There's VAT on the services that you're paying to your agent, to your lawyer, those kinds of things.
Right. Talking about taxes, tell us what role you play in the tax calculation and payments on behalf of the buyer.
On behalf of the buyer, if you are a foreign resident, I'm sure you've discussed this in other podcasts, it starts at 8%.
Yes,
we
had a whole series on mas rechisha, but I want to understand what your role is.
My role is to, first of all, make sure that the client understands that cost. It's due 60 days after you signed the contract. So even if you're not taking possession for a year, you have to pay that tax 60 days after you sign the contract. And it's my job to file the taxes and then to get the purchase tax slips. You know, there's a special voucher. And most of the time, if anyone's outside of the country, then I will help them facilitate that payment depending on where they've sent their money. If they have their own account or if they're using a currency service or for running the transaction through a trust account.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And let's talk about the signing now. So going back to these balls that you're juggling, you've checked off all the boxes and you've negotiated on the contract. You've done the due diligence, etc. You're now ready to sign. What happens?
Right. So before that stage, we will have made sure that our client approves all of the terms. And then I set the signing with the other attorney. I physically go to the seller's attorney's office, again, as the seller's attorney sends out the contract, and they also basically usually host. They're the host team, as it were.
No matter where it is in the country, you'll go?
Generally, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes when there were a couple of areas that were too dangerous recently for us to go, then we did it by courier. But there's no DocuSign in Israel. In general, you have to have original wet ink signatures on original copies of documents. Israel still loves paper. So we physically go, we sign generally 3 or 4 copies of this contract. Each lawyer keeps one, each client gets one. And the contract is the main contract and all of the appendices, which attach to the contract, for instance, would be the title registration. If, for instance, as we mentioned earlier, there was a permit that forms part of the legal title, we would attach that and the plans. We would attach, for instance, the printout of the balance of the mortgage, which is a debt of the seller to make sure that we understand if the house is rented. So there's a lease, right? We're buying it with the tenant in place, for instance, then we would attach the lease. So anything that's part of the contract, any appendix which is referenced in the contract is all attached. We sign all the other documents that we'll need, the documents to register, the lien, the note of caution that I mentioned, the documents for the tax filing, the deeds of title, which we'll get once we pay the whole purchase price, those kinds of things. So we sit and sign.
Got it. So when does your job come to an end?
My job comes to an end after the title is registered, which is not exactly when you would think it is. We're in a relationship, as it were, until I finish the transfer of title, which happens actually after you take possession. So it's kind of a multi-step process. We do the due diligence, then we sign the contract, we pay as we go along. Then at the end, you get keys in possession against the final payment. And I, as your attorney, am meant to get all of the documents that I need in order to transfer the rights. Sometimes some of those documents aren't yet ready. A certain portion of the last payment is held in trust in order to ensure that we receive those documents. Once I receive those documents, then we file to transfer the rights. Sometimes it gets held up. There's certain times a certificate is delayed for certain reasons. So generally, we try to transfer rights within a couple of months after you've received keys. Sometimes it takes a year.
So I can't imagine, Jane, I mean, juggling multiple clients for sometimes years if they're not taking possession immediately. I don't know how you manage this.
We have a lot of admin. You know, we're three attorneys in the office and four or five admins because it's a lot of, again, as you said, it's paperwork, it's deadlines, it's
and handholding.
And you can call it handholding. You know, I call it, there's a lot of psychology to it.
Absolutely.
In that way that, you know, people are trusting me and I have to make sure that I try to think of the questions to ask that wouldn't occur to them that need to be asked because it's so obvious that they are getting the oven, right?
Right.
Like, but except for it's not obvious because ovens here, it's like asking someone to leave their bed, right? You don't, it's a furnishing.
Mm-hmm.
So if it wouldn't occur to my clients to ask a certain question, I have to try to make sure that it occurs to me to bring it to their attention.
Excellent. Your office is in Yerushalayim. So do you only work with clients in Yerushalayim?
No, we work all over the country. Don't forget the country is about the size of New Jersey. So we're a small country. There's nothing that's farther than a few hours drive.
And you can do the due diligence online or
yeah,
remotely?
Most of the due diligence is done online. If we need an appraiser / planning expert or an inspector, we take someone local that knows those areas.
You have connections.
Yes.
So if somebody wants to buy in Netanya, let's say, there's no reason why not to contact you.
100%.
Great.
100%. We do a lot of work in Netanya, actually.
Great. Okay. So Jane, this has been really informative and very, very helpful for all of our listeners. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this conversation that you think is of relevance?
I think one thing that's really important to realize is that the whole process of due diligence, et cetera, and building your team of professionals is empowering. You don't have to feel that this is the last property, right? There are certain opportunities which may not come back, but if it's not the right opportunity for you, then you'll find a different opportunity. I do think that there's a huge value in owning a piece of property in Israel. People forget that we're the English-speaking set of professionals, but there's a parallel set of professionals for the Spanish-speaking Jews in the world and the French-speaking Jews in the world or wherever in the world. So all of those different communities all want a piece of Israel. So there's definitely competition, and that's one of the reasons why the prices are high. It's not just, you know, nonsense that people are trying to blow smoke to try to get you to buy it. There really is a lot of competition for these properties, but it still has to be the right deal for you. So, you know, you need to do your work slowly and build your team of professionals. And when it's right, it's right.
I agree 100%. I always say buying a home is sort of like a shidduch. If it's meant to be, it will be. And I've seen myself multiple times that things didn't always work out. Sometimes a deal fell through and it was very, very upsetting at the time. But then something better worked out. And with hindsight, it was the right thing.
100%. I always tell my clients there's a huge element of beshert. And when it's right, it's right. And don't worry, the right thing will come along.
Beautiful. Love that. Jane, do you have any crazy stories you want to share with us or anything, any scenarios that you've experienced, that you've dealt with that you'd like to share?
I mean, everybody has their crazy stories. Every time we have a story, it instructs us, right? Things that we then learn to check for the next time, you know, things that you wouldn't have occurred
to. Share one with us.
You know, listen, I had someone come to me. Thank God I hadn't represented them in the purchase, but I had someone come to me that they wanted to sell this cute little apartment on Ramban Street.
In Jerusalem.
It was this cute apartment that you kind of went down these stairs and he wanted to sell it because he had it rented out to this young couple. Now he wanted to sell it. Turns out that the whole thing had been registered only as a mahsan, as a storeroom.
Wow.
So, you know, it had market value. He could rent it, but you couldn't get a mortgage on it as an apartment.
What was it connected to? What was this?
It was like maybe it was a one room with mostly a storage room because they kind of like made this apartment. I don't know, like someone didn't do the due diligence right. I didn't represent him. So he was kind of stuck with this apartment that while he could rent it out, he couldn't really ever sell it. He couldn't really ever get the money back. I've had a lot of deals like that in Jerusalem. If you see small apartments, like 30, 40 meters, oftentimes it meant that it was once upon a time a bigger apartment, which then got illegally divided and they were selling these little apartments. So again, in the lands registry, it shows up as a perfectly legal 40-meter apartment. But if you go send out an appraiser, a planning expert, he'll come back and tell you that it was illegally divided with the two apartments on the other side and now you can't get a mortgage.
So this is a red flag. This is something you want to look out for.
Exactly. I had an apartment where my own client was selling and in remote and the whole thing was beautifully registered, except for it turns out that the whole basement didn't have a permit.
I don't believe you.
And so the other side hadn't chosen to do an appraisal beforehand. My client didn't know. If you look at it, it was perfectly registered. Again, I didn't represent them when they had purchased it. And he thought that it was perfectly registered because if you pulled the registration, it looked fine. And then the buyer, when he went to go get the mortgage, could only get a certain percentage because the entire basement didn't have a permit. At that point, again, he has no claim against the seller because he's the one who didn't decide, he didn't go out and check. You'd have to prove that the seller knew about it and hid it, which is not what happened.
Unbelievable. So this reminds me, it's so important not only to hire an attorney, but to hire a real estate attorney.
Exactly.
And not only a real estate attorney, but a real estate attorney who works in Israel. Because I've seen people in the past, they brought in a corporate lawyer, or they brought in a patent lawyer, somebody who is not an expert in real estate, or they brought in someone from their home country who works in real estate there, who's not qualified or expert in this area. And
it's just that every time we see something crazy, we're like, okay, now that instructs us for the future. Oh, one thing I do want to bring up is the Airbnb. And it's important for clients to realize that a lot of newer buildings are not allowing Airbnb.
Why is that?
The management companies of the nicer buildings obviously don't want it to be like a hotel. Mm-hmm. So it might fly under the radar, but there are certain buildings that are doing crackdowns around the world. You know, there's a kind of a movement to limit Airbnb, New York, Barcelona, all these kinds of things. So buying a property specifically for the purpose of using Airbnb has to really be looked at carefully, especially if that's your main plan of how you're going to pay back the mortgage.
Do you check like the takanon of the building?
We can check the takanon, but what I'm saying is, let's say that even if the takanon doesn't specifically prohibit it, according to Israeli tax categorization, use of Airbnb is commercial use. Mm-hmm. It's not a residential use.
Got it.
So let's say that flies under the radar, but as I said, policies can change. So there was recently a court case where they viewed use of Airbnb as commercial use and not residential use. So it's not a sure thing, and people really need to pay attention to that possibility that it will be prohibited.
Very interesting. Jane, we could continue talking for hours. There's one final question I want to address before we wrap this conversation up, and that is the usage of Shabbat elevators. A lot of people who are looking to buy in an apartment building, you know, they're thinking ahead, or they need to use an elevator on Shabbat. How do you make sure that there will be a Shabbat elevator and that they can use it before they go ahead and make the purchase?
So the only way to really ensure that you are going to have the usage of a Shabbat elevator is to buy in a building that has more than one elevator and to make sure that one of the elevators already has the Shabbat mechanism. Mm-hmm. Because if there's one elevator only, then it goes by the building vote. And that can change over time, or you can't necessarily ensure it. By law, if there's more than one elevator and there's a Shabbat mechanism in one of the elevators and there's at least one Shomer Shabbat resident, then they can demand that at least one of the elevators is being used for Shabbat. Mm-hmm. So that's really the only way to ensure it, is you have to then go to a bigger building that has at least two elevators, and then you would have more protection. Because if there's only one elevator, you can't necessarily force.
There's no guarantee.
Right. Obviously, it depends on the demographics of where you're buying. In Jerusalem, this doesn't come up as much. If you're buying in an area that is less religious and there's more people that don't want the hassle of having to wait for the Shabbat elevator every Shabbos.
Or the costs that are involved in running a Shabbat elevator.
Correct. Or let's say that the Shabbat mechanism doesn't exist in the elevator, because it's not just a simple thing. You have to actually swap out the mechanism of the elevator. So those are things that would need to be looked at if it's important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Finally, Jane, could you tell us, where do you live and what do you love about it?
I live in Modi'in, not far from you, actually. We love the proximity to all sorts of different things in the country. You know, we love actually coming home from abroad and being 20 minutes from the airport. That's fantastic. But for instance, my daughter just got married. She works both in Be'er Sheva and Jerusalem, and her husband works in Tel Aviv. So they're living in Modi'in because it's right in the
beautiful
center of everything. So the accessibility is fantastic. And also, we just have array of services. If you choose to take advantage of them, I was just walking with my friend on Shabbat, and you know, we have this outdoor ping pong tables, and people are biking and people are playing basketball and things like that. So it's a very nice community.
I agree. Couldn't agree more. And finally, Jane, if you were to move to another place in the country, where would you go and why?
I would go anywhere near the beach. I'm originally from California, so I'm really a person that's...
You're a beach girl.
I'm a beach girl. So, you know, I want somewhere that I can watch the sunset.
Okay, so where would you go?
I really like Netanya these days. You know, I think Netanya in the area called The Piano, which they have all these really cute
Iriamim
shops.
Yeah, beautiful. Iriamim,
that would be probably where I would go. So, but right now, it's not convenient for work, but you never know.
You never know. Okay. Yeah. Jane, this was great. Thank you so much for your time and
you
your
soon.
Insights. And I'm going to leave Jane's information, contact information in the show notes. If anybody would like to reach out to Jane, please feel free. Thank you so much, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening to On the House. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and share it with your family and friends. You can also visit buyitinisrael.com, where you can find news, market updates, guidance, and much more on real estate in Israel. That's buyitinisrael, buyitinisrael.com. If you have a question or a specific topic you'd like us to cover on this podcast, please email us at the address you'll find at the bottom of the show notes. Whether you're thinking about Aliyah, looking for a home or a haven, or wanting to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.